You're listening to The Spear, a podcast about the combat experience from the Modern War Institute at West Point.
More than 100 meters outside the village, you were definitely getting in a firefight.
My first patrol I took, we had a far ambush.
And then it was just a huge explosion.
The primary threat was RKG-3 grenades.
Light machine guns and AK-47s, that kind of thing.
Small arms fire, RPG fire.
Explosively formed penetrators.
Suicide bombs.
And then that's about the time that the third IED went off.
And that's when another grenade comes spinning over the side of the wall.
And it's at that point the IED chain detonates.
There was enemy in the wire.
There's all these Humvees on fire.
It was truly bullets flying from every angle that you could see.
I open the door and look outside, and all I see is muzzle flashes.
There's a guy on top with a 240, and the rounds passed right past his head.
At that point, our instincts kicked in.
One pilot on the controls, the other pilot was using his M4 to engage single-man targets on the ground.
You're shooting at everything.
It was a fight.
Liam, welcome to the show.
Hey, Charlie, thanks for having me.
Liam, I'm thrilled to have you here today to talk about your experiences downrange in both Afghanistan and Iraq and your experiences at JRTC. I think our audience will get a lot out of it. Before we go into those discussions, can you tell us a little bit about your background, what prompted you to join the Army, and what you're doing now?
I really appreciate that, Charlie, and thanks for having the time on here. You know, I look at who you've had on the podcast and feel, you know, somewhat unqualified. You know, Medal of Honor winners, 4 stars. It's really amazing to have this opportunity. You know, I grew up in a small town in central Massachusetts. My father died when I was about 11 years old, so it was me, my mom, and my brother. And pretty early on, I think about freshman year of high school, I started looking at service. I played a lot of sports, and I enjoyed leadership and realized I wanted to serve something bigger than myself. And then initially, you know, I was looking at, this is the time, you know, The Rock came out, Navy SEALs, and I thought I wanted to be a Navy SEAL and it was going to be super awesome. I didn't have great vision. And so when I was looking at a Naval Academy, I realized, like, well, if you don't become a Navy SEAL, like, you don't really like boats. But then I started looking at West Point, and really my freshman year or so, I kind of set out, this is what I want to do. I want to be something bigger. And this is in the late 90s. I really set my eyes on going to West Point, made it through the whole application process, was waitlisted coming out of my senior year, and had the benefit of getting AOG scholarship to go to New Mexico Military Institute for a year. And so I graduated high school in June of 2001. And I had been, I should rewind this, I was enlisted in the National Guard at a delayed entry program. So I went to basic training down at Fort Moore as an 11 Bravo before my senior high school, came back, did my senior year, and found out that I was going into a commissioning program, in this case, you know, the New Mexico Military Institute. So they kind of curtailed, well, not curtailed, I didn't go to AIT, I went to New Mexico Military Institute, and that's where I was on 9/11. So yeah, I was about a month-ish into college at a military school. You know, a friend of mine comes running in the room, because this was, you know, we didn't have TVs, you had a computer, but you know, it wasn't the information environment we're in now. And a friend runs in and says, hey, we're under attack. And you kind of did what? And didn't really believe it. You know, you end up finding out things over time. And I was immediately drawn to serve. I had seriously contemplated leaving NIMI to enlist in the Army, try to go on airborne contract, because we knew a war was coming and thought I was going to miss it. And my mom talked me through and said, you worked really hard to, you know, try to get into West Point. You can make more of an impact if you stick with your original goal. And fortunately, to my mom's credit, I listened to her, stuck through the year, got into West Point the following year. So for the class of 2006, entered West Point there, you know, in the summer of 2002 to go to Beast. And then, you know, the common theme happens. We come back from spring break in 2003 and the Iraq invasion happens. And there we are again, like, oh man, we're going to miss this thing. It's going to be over. It was very sobering and also surreal being a cadet at that time, going from being a plebe, seeing Iraq and reading about in the New York Times every morning and, you know, getting asked the news and everything, to the point where come our junior and senior year, you know, there were there's probably not a week that went by that the first captain didn't announce the death of a graduate from the poop deck. So it made it very real. President Bush was the speaker at our graduation, talking about, you know, what we needed to do to win in our time. And it was very real when you then went on a commission as an infantry officer through the basic officer leader course and through Ranger School, realizing I found out when I was at the academy, I'd be going to the 101st Airborne Division and realizing, you know, you're going to get to Fort Campbell when you get out of Ranger School, you're going to go to there, you're going to train for a little bit, but chances are at that time, three brigades were going to Iraq and one brigade was going to Afghanistan. I think I had 40 something classmates that went to Fort Campbell, just an infantry branch. So it was very real. And this is, you know, the tail end of the initial surge in terms of the first five brigades that went in. So I arrived at Fort Campbell, went to JRTC, went on leave, went to Iraq in October of 2007 as a weapons platoon leader. So I spent 14 months in Northwest Baghdad during what I would call initially a fairly quiet first few months. And then come February of 2008, things started to pick up. And then in March 2008, I was there for the Shia uprising, March Madness, Shia Tet, if you will, that kind of Sadrist uprising that occurred. You had Sergeant Major of the Army Daily talking about that on the other side of the river from where I was at in Western Baghdad. You know, so we stayed through there. I was a two-time platoon leader in Iraq for 14 months, came back, did some XO time, went to the maneuver captain's career course. Out of there, I got assigned to the 5th Strike Brigade Combat Team, 2nd Infantry Division out of Fort Lewis. So I graduated career course, went to Fort Lewis, which had just changed to Joint Base Lewis-McChord, and immediately deployed to Afghanistan for the tail end of what was the first Striker Brigade rotation in Afghanistan. It was a very, very kinetic deployment for them. I think the brigade lost about 50 soldiers, 46 to 50 soldiers, that deployment in Kandahar. I was there as an assistant S3 the last 4 months. So my experience, you know, was much different than those initially when we showed up, and essentially the brigade conducted a deliberate clearance of a deliberate defense that the Taliban had in place in the Argandab River Valley and going out into Zari District. So I was the guy that was in the talk, kind of planning the next operations and planning the relief in place with the unit that was coming in for us, because this was 2010. You know, we were there before the Afghan surge, and we were replaced by the Afghan surge. So we had companies that were getting replaced by battalions, you know, platoons getting replaced by companies. So everything scaled up a level. So there was a large deal of logistical planning that had to go into that, as we were really ripping over with elements of the 2nd Brigade of the 101st, elements of, I think, 4th Infantry Division. It was, you know, you're there setting the conditions for the coming fight. And that rotation, we were out in Maywand District, which really, if you know the district, or you know, Afghanistan sits between Kandahar City and Helmand. And we were there during the invasion at Helmand. So a lot of what we did was secure Highway 1 for all the logistics that were running through Maywand, making their way out to Helmand to the Marines for, I think it was Operation Mostarik. But that the large scale invasion into Helmand, that marked really the beginning of the surge. So not an overly difficult, if you will, deployment for me, because it was only about 4 months. So I came back to Joint Base Lewis-McChord, took command of a rifle company, and then deployed that rifle company back to the Argandab River Valley in about April of 2012. And that was a significant emotional event, because many of those soldiers had been in the previous deployment when they went into the Argandab River Valley. You know, we had a battalion when they initially entered the Argandab that I think lost about 20 soldiers in 3 weeks. And so we had soldiers that had been there, and they're like, I have not, you know, not that they weren't going to go back, but just very apprehensive about going back there. And what we found through the hard work of several rotations before us is, you know, the Argandab had really turned into more of a facilitation zone. So the terrain was very difficult, but I think the Taliban had left out of the Argandab, which, you know, sits between Kandahar City and kind of the mountains to the north, and pushed further out. So it wasn't overly kinetic, but it was very dynamic as a company commander. You know, you're dealing with tribal politics. You're dealing with trying to have malaks in villages. We were dealing with closing combat outposts. So we fell in as a battalion. You think a rifle battalion has about, you know, 14, 15 platoons, depending on how you count it. We fell in on like 18 combat outposts as a battalion. And then when we left, 9 months later, we were down to 5. So there was, although not a great deal of kinetic activity, there's a lot of tribal dynamics. And then there was also the trying to get the force right size. And we were there also in 2012, 2013, we had a huge uptick of green on blue, which really put constraints on our ability to operate, as well as on our relationship with the Afghans we were working with, because we were putting in very high levels of you need two American soldiers to every one Afghan you're patrolling with, yet we're living on these platoon outposts that, you know, there's 30 Afghans, there's 30 Americans. It's good in theory that you're going to separate them from each other. But when you're on a COP, we had this one combat outpost, Timothy Johnson, you know, it was like 100 meters long and like 50 meters wide, shaped like a peanut. There's no way you could achieve separation between forces. So it was a difficult time to be there. Learned a lot as a company commander, because you're just having platoons out on their own combat outpost doing 2-3 patrols a day at the squad level, and you're trying to manage that, integrate that. Really great experience. And then coming out of company command, so I changed in Afghanistan from being the Bravo company commander to the HAC commander in my battalion. Came back and pretty immediately had the fortune of going to Boston to go to grad school at Tufts University to get a master's degree at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy. So I spent 2 years on the Army's dime in Boston getting a graduate degree in international relations. And that was a really interesting period for me, having just walked out of company command, having done at that point 3 combat deployments, to start thinking through what it was I had done and like really have the time to process through what I was doing. So I spent 2 years in Boston, again, from Massachusetts, got to be close to my family, which is awesome. You know, my younger brother had his second kid when I was there. So a good 2 years. The Army sent me to Fort Leavenworth for Command and General Staff College after I was done Boston. So that was a nice, I was in school and kind of back in the Army. So I had to wear a uniform every day. So you're kind of slowly going back in the Army, but not back in a brigade combat team. And then after Fort Leavenworth, I got stationed at Fort Carson, Colorado. Initially, I served with the division staff. So I immediately deployed forward into Germany. So this is, you know, right with about 2 years after the invasion of Crimea by the Russians, but before this massive buildup. So our whole thing there, you know, we did not have forces in Poland or anything. It was all in Germany. And we were the division that was there to really set the conditions as the, what we called the mission command element of the division forward, to set the conditions for what would become the first heel to toe armored brigade combat team rotation actually going into Poland. So we had done episodic things after the invasion of Crimea as an army, where forces would go forward and they would draw pre-positioned stocks, but we wouldn't send a whole brigade forward with their equipment. So I did that for about 7 months, got the first, it was 3rd Brigade, 4th ID, the first brigade to go full heel to toe into Europe and into Poland and set kind of the conditions for what we look at now. Then after that, I went down to 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team of 4th Infantry Division, where I was a battalion S3 for 2nd Battalion, 23rd Infantry. Did a few months there, and I got pulled up to be the Brigade S3 for 1st Brigade. We knew we were deploying to Afghanistan, but I switched out right before the deployment. So I deployed to Eastern Afghanistan this time as the Brigade S3. But in our role with the drawdown that had happened to this point, as the Brigade S3, I was also the G3 for Train Advise Assist Command East. So basically, I was the operations officer working for a one-star general that was responsible for all operations in Eastern Afghanistan. And in this time, this was 2018, 2019, the 1st Security Force Assistance Brigade had deployed to Afghanistan. So for the first time since about 2014, 2015, we actually had American soldiers outside the wire. Now, they were on brigade level or battalion level combat outposts at the Afghan level advising, but helping integrate U.S. fires in the fight against both the Taliban and ISIS. It was interesting when we were there, because you started to see the Taliban and ISIS fighting each other and pitting that together. So that was a hard deployment, just from an op tempo and what we were doing, because it's, you're not in control anymore. You know, we had advisors that were working with the partners, but there's no longer U.S. forces on the ground. We're coordinating a lot of indirect and air close air support, etc. But it was a difficult deployment in terms of just it was a nonstop grind, because there wasn't not that much left for forces. And then after that assignment, I went to go stand up the 5th Security Force Assistance Brigade at Joint Base Lewis McChord. So I was a brigade operations officer there. Worked really getting that formation, which was almost immediately oriented on the Indo-Pacific, integrated into a theater that had never seen this formation before. So there had been a blueprint on how SFABs fought in Afghanistan, but how we integrate them into a theater and competition like the Indo-Pacific, there was no playbook. So we had to figure out a lot of what that looked like with U.S. Army Pacific and with U.S. Indo-PACOM for the authorities. I mean, we were building a plane in flight. My boss felt bad for me after doing about 2 years in that job, where he let me go be a company commander of an advisor team. So I took about a 24-person element. We did a couple of short-duration missions in Japan, and then we went to Mongolia and worked with the Mongolian Land Forces. While I was in Mongolia, found out that I had been selected for battalion command, came back from Mongolia. I moved out of the SFAB. I moved over to First Corps, where I worked in the Commander's Initiative Group for the First Corps Commander for about a year, and really continued to work that strategic level engagement in the Indo-Pacific, and helped the CG kind of frame his problems and what his messaging was. We went places to Japan, we went to Thailand, and really great exposure to more operational, high operational level leadership. And then in June of 2023, I took command of 4th Battalion, 9th Infantry Regiment, the Manchus at Fort Carson, Colorado, back in 1st Striker Brigade Combat Team. And that's where, you know, that's where we see me now. I've been there for about 20 months, and it's been a great experience. I had the benefit of doing a National Training Center rotation and a Joint Readiness Training Center rotation while in command. And yeah, it's been a real great experience, Charlie. So went a bit long, but that's kind of the once over the world.
Well, that's quite a career, Liam. And I want to talk specifically later on in this episode about your experiences at JRTC, because I think that's an excellent example of how what you do in training pays off in combat. But I'd like to go back to Baghdad, Iraq, when you were a platoon leader. And there was a very interesting vignette you told me earlier before we started recording that involved an IED strike. And I wonder if you could explain to our audience what you were doing at that time, the circumstances around that episode.
Yeah, sure. So my platoon, when I arrived to Fort Campbell, was we were a weapons platoon. So it's a bit smaller, about 18 people, but we were assigned, you know, as a kind of a mounted formation already operating with Humvees to be the, you know, we call it the PSD, but, you know, the basically the security for our battalion commander. Because you know, you're talking the surge, we're 4 years, 5 years into the war, we learned our lesson. You can't just drive around Iraq with one vehicle in an insurgency, like people will get killed. So my platoon's job was basically to help secure the battalion commander getting from point A to point B. And in a counterinsurgency, you know, that was pretty nonstop. I think over the course of the 14 months we were there, we did 450 plus combat patrols. You're talking 2-3 a day, just driving all over Baghdad as the battalion commander visits platoons, as he visits Iraqi checkpoints, as he visits companies, as he's all over the place. And so we got a lot of experience out and about, and it had changed. And it's the changing character of TTPs is always interesting, because in the unit I was in 2007, most of my NCOs had been in that same battalion for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. They had gone back in 2005, 2006, south of Baghdad, a place, you know, Mamadiya, Lutafia, Yusufiya, the Triangle of Death. And then we went back to Baghdad in 2007. And so, you know, these NCOs and most of my soldiers had a great amount of experience in Iraq, but all in different locations. And so it was kind of, you know, at one point in time, the whole mantra in Iraq was, you know, speed is security. And with the introduction of EFPs, that kind of turned on its head. So it was driving at like 5 miles an hour or slower, just scanning, looking for EFPs. Because if, you know, if that enemy weapon system engaged on even a MRAP, if the copper blast projectile array was correct, I mean, it's going to kill whatever it goes through. And so we had a pretty quiet first like 3 or 4 months. There wasn't much that was happening, which was surprising because it had been a very busy summer in terms of kinetic activity before we arrived. And we changed out with really elements of two brigades. We're still realigning a lot of stuff in Baghdad because of the surge. And we're talking 5 additional brigades. I think U.S. presence in Iraq at the time was 180,000 soldiers or something insane like that. It was huge. And then starting in kind of January, February of 2008, we started to see not necessarily direct fire engagements pick up, but we started to actually see the effects of EFPs. And so we went through kind of a series of, in fairly short order, kind of starting in February 2008, where our soldiers would be out on patrol and the vehicles would get hit with EFPs. And you're talking catastrophic consequences. I think our first one resulted in losing a staff sergeant in one of our companies. We had one about a week or two later where we lost three soldiers in an EFP strike. And then about a week after that, the incident that we had talked about, we were establishing combat outposts in Shula, which is this neighborhood in northwest Baghdad. We hear about Sadr City a lot. It's really the west side of the river's little cousin neighborhood in terms of Shia militia activity. And that just frankly, other than special operations forces, nobody had been in for a couple of years. So as we were, working underneath multinational core Iraq and underneath the 4th Infantry Division, we were trying to expand security and take the security, into areas that we hadn't been. So we had one of our companies was working on establishing the first combat outpost in Shula. And one morning they were out there, I believe they were escorting, flat racks of T-walls and things like that to go out to establish this cop. And they had an IED strike. And what we were seeing with the complexity of these EFPs was, they were very well camouflaged. They were able to essentially take these, we're really looking at large PVC pipes with a copper disc packed with explosives, but kind of mold them into piles of trash, et cetera. And the TTP at the time is they would use essentially an infrared beam that when the vehicle cut that, it would trigger, and then the actual projectiles would be offset, and they would aim for the gunner, they would aim for the driver's door, the TC's door. It would just penetrate through supersonic through any level of armor and with catastrophic effects. So this morning, our Bravo company got hit by an EFP, and the driver of that vehicle severely injured. Both extremities and both of his legs were gone. They're pulling him out. They're working through trying to stabilize him, secure the site. And it's the it almost sounds cliche, but when you're when you're a cadet, when you're an eyeball, like we talk about, the friction of battle and all these things. And there you are. And so to be clear, we weren't there immediately at the strike. When I was with the boss, and he would be the first one on scene anytime anything happened, because he was the battalion commander, he kind of had the time to, hey, this just happened, we're moving now. And it's almost like we're in constant QRF. So when we get down there, the soldiers in pretty rough shape, they got tourniquets on them, they're working through a 9-line medevac, they've secured the scene. And it's just that level of, if it can go wrong, it will go wrong. And I remember being there as we're helping expand the security perimeter and work through things that as the platoon's kind of in shock still from this strike, we're watching as the 9-line has gone in and you're seeing the two Blackhawks come in and you realize that, they're going to the combat outpost location, not the HLZ on the strike site that we called. And now you're talking about, losing 4 or 5 minutes that you don't have. They ultimately get to the right location. The soldier get loaded up. He would later die of his wounds. But it's a pretty traumatic experience. And then just when you think, things are kind of calm and quiet as you're, digging through the rubbish of a vehicle and trying to start cleaning up everything that's left behind from that, I hear another explosion, probably a kilometer or two south of us. And so, here you are picking up pieces of, burned up 1151 vehicle and all this other stuff. You just seen an American soldier. We had lost time as an organization on the medevac because of mistakes. And then you hear another strike. And in that moment, I'm just out there and I'm just like, fuck, really loud. And fortunately, that second strike, actually, there were no casualties that were taken. And it would be what I would think, something you wouldn't really even remember as an incident. But later that evening, I'm back at our combat outpost at the battalion headquarters, and my battalion commander sees me. And he can tell, at this point, as I had mentioned earlier, I think we'd had, three fatal IED strikes within the last 3 weeks or so. It was almost like every week they were happening. And he pulls me in and he says something along the lines of, Liam, this is affecting you. And if you didn't care about what you're doing, it wouldn't. And if you didn't care, you shouldn't be doing what you're doing. But, you know, what you do matters and your soldiers are looking to you. And if you let it go like that, and if you're emotional, your soldiers are going to be emotional. It kind of drew this lesson back to me that had been, you know, imparted in my head going back to Camp Buckner. I think my Buckner platoon trainer had kind of hammered on us, and when conditions are at their worst, leaders need to be at their best. And you always hear that and you always think you're going to be that leader. And I think for some of us, you know, we're all deeply invested in our work and in our soldiers, and it becomes so hard when you're actually out there and bullets are flying and people are dying to get super amped up. But what your leader, what you're doing matters. And if you're the person that's out there, you know, it wasn't that I was running around with a chicken with my head cut off, but you need to be the calm above the storm. And it sounds, again, it sounds really cliche, but there I was after knowing these things for, you know, 4 years at West Point and all this time. And you're the guy that's out there just like, fuck, and it affects your soldiers. And it was a big lesson that I took away, that, you know, my boss took the time to relay that to me, because it does matter. And if, whether, you know, whether that's Iraq, whether that's in a training event, your soldiers are going to look to you for how you are, and what you do is going to set the tone for how your organization reacts.
So, Liam, did you say this was your first deployment?
This would be my first deployment.
Yeah, and you mentioned that a lot of the soldiers that were in your platoon had combat experience. Is that correct?
Yeah, this was in 2007. Most of my, and even my, you know, PFCs and specialists had, a lot of them had combat experience. Those are the days of stop loss as well. So you also had soldiers that were, you know, they didn't really want to be there, but the Army told them, like, you're going to finish out this deployment and then you can get out of the Army. So, you know, it was interesting because you had NCOs and soldiers that had experience, but it was almost, you know, if you read the book Black Hearts, that was my battalion, the previous deployment where most of my soldiers are at. And that was, you know, a knockdown gunfight almost each and every day, getting IEDs, but it was, you know, you're running over a 50-gallon jug of explosives or a 155 round. Usually the IEDs, people walked away. So the whole TTP was, hey, we're going to go as fast as we can and see if they can time it with a, you know, a victim detonated or a command wire. Whereas now with the EFPs, it was like, there is no surviving this if you don't find it. And I think, you know, there were some mental shifts that had happened. And then I think the other big side of it too, that was from a leader challenge, is I talk about an incident, you know, and I think this is one of the lasting kind of lessons of combat is, you know, it's 99% boredom and then like 1% terror. And so over the course of 14 months, you know, I can count on probably two hands the number of like really kinetic engagements we had. So that means there's, you know, 420-ish days out there where not much happened. But you have to be ready for that worst day. But that also led to us, it gets really hard when you're in a city like Baghdad and there's people just trying to live their life. And we're trying to make sure that the population, you know, has a better future. But then, you know, everything's all good. Everything's good. And then, you know, one of our scout platoon pulls out the front gate and they get hit with an EFP literally at the gate and kill one of their squad leaders. And then you're trying to go back into the population and, you know, patrol through markets and work with the Iraqi National Police to build governance. It was just a really hard mission, that you learn a ton from, but it's not easy. And then it's also, to your earlier point, working through kind of having to modify those TTPs, because, you know, I always say I probably could have gone back to the exact same area of Baghdad a year later and what we did there wouldn't have worked the next time, because things are always changing. You have to be smart on what are the conditions on the ground now and how are things. And I think that was a lesson that our NCOs worked through, because their experience in the invasion had been, you know, 101st drive into Karbala, taking Baghdad, and then up, wasn't until they got up to Crit that they kind of set into stability operations. Then when they went back for the second deployment, you know, as I always heard, the back in Yusufia stories, as my soldiers would always tell me, it was just very different. And when you look about the controlled application of violence, it was, you know, it was just a whole lot different than it had been for their previous two deployments.
So what was the dynamic like for you as a new combat leader in a unit that was full of soldiers who had been downrange once or twice before? What was that like for you?
It's a really good question. You know, I think the benefit we had was NCOs that had done this for a minute. So they knew they had to, like, your platoon leader, you're going to get a new platoon leader. So it's incumbent on them to kind of train the platoon leader on, this is what we need to do. And hey, sir, this is, you know, this is your role. This is the platoon sergeant's role. Our mission was a little, you know, different than what, say, a rifle platoon would do patrolling. And I would later do another platoon in that rotation that was, you know, more kind of just providing security operations and just going out, walking out the gate versus driving the boss from point A to point B. But they realized they had to develop their lieutenant. We had some great NCOs. When you look at the experiences that they had, but also their willingness to work through, to understand, hey, the sir's doing the mission planning. He's doing the patrol brief up front. We're doing the debrief on the backside. You know, I did a lot of the coordination with, we were partnered with the Iraqi National Police. So I would coordinate with Iraqi National Police in terms of joint combined patrols, and they would work on all of our PCIs and PCCs. But it was also, we look back at 2007, 2008, it was literally the experience of pretty much every lieutenant in the United States Army at the time. It was like, you're going to go to Iraq, and then a few people were going to go to Afghanistan. And so everybody had that experience, because come 2007, pretty much every brigade in the Army had deployed at least once. So I was fortunate to have some great NCOs that really helped show me the right way and like help define, this is what the non-commissioned officer side should be doing to make sure should we go on the mission. And this is what you need to be doing from a leadership perspective, from working with a company commander. When I took my second platoon on, hey, here's your assigned area of operations. This is how we're going to move the ball forward with the national police partners that we're working with. This is like the intelligence that we're gathering in the different mahallas or neighborhoods in Baghdad. You know, I found it to be really rewarding when I look back on that deployment, in terms of seeing the average person in Qadamiya, and realizing, and it stuck with me, like these people just want a better life for their kids. And that's universal. Whether you're in the United States, whether you're in Baghdad, people just want a better life for their kids. And, 99.99% of the people that we would patrol through, these massive markets in Qadamiya, going down to the Qadamiya Shrine, where your little 18 person platoon would get engulfed in 50,000 people. But talking with kids, and we would, on Thursday nights, there'd be nights where the cop would take rockets, and we're like, we would walk back from patrol in our body armor and realize we'd have to stay in body armor on the fob, if you will, because we were taking indirect fire. So we just walk back out the gate and go on patrol and like go buy, euros or gauze on the market and go stop by businesses and talk with people, because the pendulum has started to shift to the right, where the security, all the hard work and fighting in the last 2 years has really started to pay off, which I thought was really rewarding. Leaving Iraq in late 2008 and being like, we made a difference in what we did. And you saw it as a first line, ground level platoon leader that's, walking on the ground day in and day out and seeing like these people. Most of them, not all of them, most of them were very generous, or not generous, they were grateful for the work that we had done when we were leaving towards the end of the surge. So we hear all this negativity, and rightfully so, about the number of casualties that we had taken at that point in Iraq, but there's a lot of hard fighting that got us to that point where, a lot of platoons like mine had done a lot of hard work and a lot of hard fighting and a lot of hard, the stuff that's harder than fighting, probably, the working with your partner force, whether it's Iraqi Army or National Police, whether it's, local governance or just business keepers, to make a better place to support the Iraqi government. So really rewarding experience.
I like the point that you raised about, I'm going to paraphrase here, about how a leader sets the temperature emotionally within the organization, and especially how when situations are at their worst, that's when leaders need to be at their best. And if we fast forward a little bit in your career to Afghanistan, there was another opportunity for leaders to be at their best when a forward operating base was attacked and infiltrated by the Taliban. Can you tell us about that as well?
Yeah. So this was probably midway through my second deployment to Afghanistan when I was a company commander of a rifle company, Bravo Company 2-1 Infantry. And kind of similar to Baghdad, this had been we were in the Arghandab River Valley, which had been referred to as the heart of darkness under the Taliban. It was the birthplace of the Taliban. And up until my unit's first deployment there that I talked about earlier, it had been kind of run by the Canadians, but generally there hadn't been any forces there until our brigade went with the initial invasion of the Arghandab in 2009. I think we had about two brigades, maybe one or two brigades between that initial push in the Arghandab. And when we came back, we found it to be fairly quiet and much more of a political problem. So I spent a lot of time, it's amazing. I was a 29 year old company commander, and, getting the charge of like, hey, you got to help Kavaji Molk this village, figure out who their Malik is, because they ran this guy out of town. And here you are as a company commander sitting in Shuras, and there was no help from Bataan. I mean, it was you are the king of the Northern Argandab, as a company commander, which is kind of crazy. And it generally stayed pretty quiet, because I think it had turned into more of a facilitation zone where there was, I'm sure, some kind of not coercion, but agreement between the local government, the local NA, and the Taliban. And just, hey, we're not going to mess with the Argandab for the most part. The story was a little bit different. North of the Argandab is a place called Shah Wali Kot. And we had viewed it, and it had been in for a while, of kind of an economy of force mission. So our field artillery battalion was up there. Much less manned. They're doing infantry stuff, not field artillery stuff, security operations. And Shah Wali Kot had gotten pretty... it had gotten pretty kinetic. So they were, on this particular day of this incident, the unit was actually getting ready for a battalion level air assault. Most of the, you think about the size of a field artillery battalion, it is not nearly as big as an infantry battalion. So most of their combat power is getting ready, and they're loading up on CH-47s to go to one of the remote areas to do a clearance operation. And what ended up happening was, I think it was about 10 Taliban. We often don't give our enemies credit for kind of their cunning and their ability to adapt. And what they had done was they had essentially crept up to this place, Fob Frontenac, under canvas bags and things. So they blocked the heat signature that would have been seen on infrared cameras as they moved up to infiltrate. They cut the wire, the C wire, and then the chain link fence. They got inside the fob and had done their recon. So they immediately moved to the power generators. They blew up the generators, cut the power to the base, started moving through, leaving satchel charges in all the bomb shelters, knowing soldiers would go there, and essentially started raining havoc. And so had it not been that battalion headquarters had been like alert, and in the middle of a battalion operation, so everybody was kind of up and doing their job, and had it not been a sleepy Tuesday night when you got the RTO and the night battle cap and nobody else is up, it might have been very different. But we tie into this is they're under attack. They were probably 15, 20 kilometers north of my location. And so we get the call that says, hey, you need to send a QRF up there. And so I alerted my fourth platoon. We had stood up as a striker formation. We normally had three platoons, and we used to have the mobile gun system platoon of the armor guys. And what we had done, realizing how many combat outposts we had to man, is we task organized our own fourth platoon by kind of slicing a squad from here and there. So our fourth platoon was kind of this new amalgamation that didn't exist before we went to Afghanistan, and it kind of had a lot of challenges with identity and things like that, and they kind of struggled. So we kept them with the company headquarters initially because they just needed some help, but they were the only option that we had. Gave a very quick warning order to the platoon leader. I was like, hey, Steve, you got to get up there, get on. Here's the frequency for 217, the field artillery battalion. When you get up there, make comms with them. You're going to be working for them, and, keep comms with us, get comms with them, and go up there and, try to help them out in the situation. We don't really know what's going on other than they're under attack. And so they start making their way up in their strikers. And we had an old blimp, we used to call the PTIS, the persistent threat detection system. So this large aerostat blimp in the sky with really good cameras that we'd always tell the operators to look at things we want them to look at, not the things they were supposed to be looking at. So in this, we were able to kind of tell them, like, hey, I need you to watch up towards Frontenac. And so what we're watching is essentially at the max distance this blimp can watch, about 20 kilometers out. I'm seeing as my vehicles are coming up towards the gate of a Fob Frontenac, and I barely have my platoon leader on FM comms. And I'm like, hey, do you have comms with 217, the gaining units? I said, I don't. And I'm like, oh, this isn't good. And I can barely see them. I can barely talk to them. And I'm watching on the blimp as we're seeing like American soldiers still running, spraying M4s from the hip. And you talk about, it's kind of the message to Garcia, giving this lieutenant, but, hey, go up there, figure it out. He was fortunate. They were able to get in there, kind of out of contact, link in with the unit. And the unit was very clear on, hey, here's what we need you to do. And, the kind of the story of that fought up front in that fight that, you know, probably kept it from being, you know, front page news was, you know, there had been soldiers up for that attack, and there had been a soldier and their forward support company or their predecessor, you know, their logistics element, you know, that had been up on a 50 cal and it had some good shots inside the FOB on the Taliban as they were coming through. So by the time my platoon got up there, I think there was only around two Taliban left inside the wire. They had barricaded themselves inside the refrigerator, you know, trailer, the reefer van outside the DFAC. And so my platoon realized, I'm like, I don't know how we're gonna get these guys out. They linked up with an EOD team that was up there, essentially put C4 to do an explosive breach into the reefer van, and then threw in enough hand grenades to clear the threat out of there. And then they were essentially up at FOB Frontenac for the next 2 days, kind of clearing through the security perimeter because we didn't know what was coming next. And so I look at that example in terms of, and we'll talk a little bit later about, you know, positive leadership and positive energy, but, you know, to that point of when conditions are at their worst, leaders have to be at their best. You know, for my platoon leader, you know, he got told, hey, here's a frequency, here's where you need to go, and go execute. No idea of the situation. And to my earlier point, you know, if he had been, you know, super sketched out about it, if he had pushed back, if he had not understood, but he just took the mission and ran with it. And the platoon did an exceptional job up there. And you know, when you look back at things that you're proud of on that deployment, you know, absolutely looking at what they were able to do with, you know, very little guidance other than go up there and figure it out. You know, just looking at formative experience from a leadership perspective, as well as on like commander's intent and things like that.
So that's an amazing story of young leaders being able to adapt in situations of VUCA, volatility, uncertainty, complexity, and ambiguity. But that doesn't happen spontaneously, right? You've got to train for that. You've got to prepare for it. So how did you prepare your company to have that kind of ability to execute when they were downrange?
That's a really good and complex question. You know, we were able to, I think, you know, two major training events. We had a National Training Center rotation. And, you know, back then, the National Training Center rotations were very much aimed towards counterinsurgency, not nearly at the scale they needed to be. You know, I think we lived as a company on like one FOB versus platoon FOBs. But the National Training Center still provides excellent training. I remember, you know, we were doing, you know, a security operation during, I think, you know, it was Six Lanes. But, you know, the NTC back then did a very good job when you started talking about like training enablers, when you would, you know, they would have an actual explosion inside of a village, like a no crap explosion, and you'd come up on it and there would be a role player, you know, somebody who only had one leg in real life. So it's not just, you know, it's about as real as it gets with blood spraying and things like that to help train our soldiers for what they were going to see. So I think the tough, realistic training we had there, but then also just, you know, focusing on the basics, when we did brigade level FTXs and things like that, on you may not be able to replicate every condition, but at the time, you know, the basics still very much tied to, you know, physical fitness, marksmanship, first aid, things that we've been talking about for decades. And you know, then it's, you can apply the little TTPs like fives and 25s with like scans when you get outside your vehicle. But you have to have the basics, right? With, you know, physical fitness, marksmanship, first aid are so important. And then it's the leadership of it too. So, you know, I think one of the big challenges for us getting ready for that deployment was just making sure that we capitalized on the combat experience, because we had about a year between deployments there from our last deployment, which had been extremely kinetic, integrated new soldiers into the company, and then just focused on, you know, ensuring that we were tactically sound if we came into contact and were able to react to contact. You know, back in Kandahar in 2012, 2013, you know, it was the days of everybody had to walk in a file behind a mine detector because the Taliban had gotten so good on, you know, little soda bottle IEDs that would, you know, blow off your leg. But then when you went to go CASAVAC somebody, they would have more IEDs in the natural CASAVAC area. They just knew our TTPs. So we had to be smart about it. And you can't train all that at home station. And I would argue, even today, when we look at large scale combat operations, short of being at a combat training center, you can't get all of the training enablers you might want and make it perfect, but you can still focus on the basics and the battle drills at like the squad and platoon level. Because, you know, we knew okay, hey, going to Afghanistan, like this is the TTPs talking with the guys we're replacing. Like, we got to train on react to contact with everybody in the line. And what does that look like when you can't establish a base of fire, you know, perpendicular to the enemy where you're taking contact from? So what does that even look like when everything that hasn't been cleared by this minesweeper is, you know, lava, for a lack of a better term? So I think marksmanship, physical fitness, medical, but then also, you know, the tolerance for ambiguity and understanding that you've got to adjust to the situation.
One of the ways that we help young leaders prepare to function in the conditions of high stress and ambiguity is through the combat training centers like you were talking about. And the reason I got in contact with you, Liam, as you know, but our readers don't, is that I read an article in a publication called From the Green Notebook called The Commander's Reflection on Failure and Perseverance, which you wrote, which focused on an experience you had with your unit at JRTC, the Joint Readiness Training Center, in which a lot of things went pretty badly. And I wonder if you could talk us through that vignette and focus on what I took away from that as the main takeaway, the power of yet. Can you talk to us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. So we went to the Joint Readiness Training Center this last November, so pretty recently. And for a little history, you know, I had been in command. I took command in June of 2023, and we went to the National Training Center in August of 2023. And actually, we had a very good rotation. I mean, I hadn't been in command that long, but a very good unit. And then over the course of the next 12, 13 months, you know, everything we had done as a battalion from a warfighting perspective was incredibly well done. Very lethal, very tenacious battalion that can accomplish the mission. And so we went to the JRTC, and we knew it would be different. We were a striker formation going to JRTC, which normally doesn't happen. You know, it's a much smaller training area than NTC, much more congested, much more, you know, wooded. So as a motorized formation, it's hard. The Op 4 there is, you know, very much more. They have tanks and fighting vehicles, but it's still very much a close light infantry fight. So we knew it would be difficult, and I knew it would be difficult. I don't want to say I didn't realize how difficult it would be, because I don't think it was any harder for us than anyone else. But we, as a battalion, the first few days, just we couldn't get out of our way. And this is what really prompted me to write the article, was we just kept messing things up. You know, I highlight in there, you know, we were the unit, we did live fires up front and then did force on force. So we were the unit, we talked about it for 6 months ahead of rotation, like, hey, we're doing live fires up front. So like when we clear everything, when we are doing shakedowns of ammo, like we are not going to be the unit that brings live ammo into the box. And, you know, lo and behold, about 2 or 3 days in the rotation, we were the unit that brought live ammo into the box. You know, we had huge challenges up front with, you know, negligent discharges, fratricide, just nothing was going right for us. And as a leader, particularly of an organization that I've seen perform so well, it became so hard not to just become super negative and like take it all personally. And what I realized, you know, the turning point why I called the article Move Forward was we did our first AAR. Let me back it up a little bit. So we had all these, kind of negative encounters that were, predominantly self-imposed. Like, there were mistakes that we made. They were, you know, lack of attention to detail, stuff that I knew we were better than. And then we were getting ready for this large scale attack as a battalion. You know, we had kind of war gamed the rotation, and NTC or JRTC is so small. You know, as a brigade, we're basically like, all right, well, we're going to put 2 battalions in the north, 1 battalion in the south, and 4-9. You guys will be the battalion in the south, which means we're going to have to go to low water crossing 5, which anybody with JRTC experience knows that that's, you know, it's one of those kind of seminal locations in CTC history, you know, the fight for low water crossing 5. And we were like, we are not going to attack this thing heads on and do what they want us to do. So we had looked at how we were going to essentially conduct a dismounted, they call it envelopment, really a dismounted penetration to get behind the enemy's defense with 2 companies. And after all this stuff had been going wrong, you know, tactically, it's going right. Like, everything is working out. Like, there's the friction, but we thought we were going to have challenges with comms. I'm still able to talk with both company commanders. There's some, you know, they crossed like two chest deep rivers to get there. Just the level of absolute tenacity that our soldiers showed was just amazing. And you know, it's like, hey, this is finally going the way we need it to, and we're finally fighting the way that we can. And then they get up on the Huff military compound, which is really, we talk about low water crossing five, this, you know, this crossing of this kind of bridge area, but really what it is this trench complex that's about a kilometer south that we didn't want to attack directly into. So we try to attack it from behind, and we got a company in there, and then they just got wiped out and like just completely culminated on the objective. And it was, you know, things were going bad. And then we're finally tactically proven what we can do. And then we just get killed. And it was so demoralizing. And we go, you know, we do a quick hot wash with our OCs. And then as a battalion commander, I have to go to like the brigade, the large AR. And, you know, it was hard for me as somebody who cares about this organization, knows this organization can fight and saw how badly it went. And, you know, you take it personally and you realize, and then I hate to admit it because as a leader, you think you don't get there. But I was at the point where I was starting to feel sorry for myself. And that's a very bad place to be as a leader. And why I realized I had to talk about this in the article was I don't think we talk about failure enough because I felt like a failure. You know, had we seized the Huff military compound, it would have been like, hey, we're great. But like, it just, we couldn't do anything right. And so I'm sitting this AR, you know, with a, you know, a lump in my throat, just pissed off, just feeling like we can't do anything right. And our deputy commanding general gets up, and you know, he had some tough love for us, essentially. Hey, this isn't how you guys thought it was going to go. You thought you're going to be doing a lot better. But I need you to do something. I need you to move forward. And when he said that, you know, he's like, move forward. You have soldiers to lead, and how you lead them matters. And nothing that I say here is new or special, but to me that just stuck. Because we look at, how do you move forward? How do you move forward to the next objective? How do you move beyond the failure of yesterday? How do you move up to the next thing that you have to do? And that coupled with something that my brigade commander, Colonel Keller, would always talk about. He'll talk about the power of yet. You know, hey, we haven't figured out how to master digital fires yet, or we haven't defeated the enemy yet, but we're not done yet. We still have time. We've been talking the power of yet for a while, and it was one of the mantras of our brigade, but that notion of move forward, you know, I just sat there and I realized, I was looking back at my notebook the other day, and I just, you know, I see it as a, you know, move forward. And I just use that as an anchor to tie everything that I did to. And so what I found was, you know, I was in a tough spot, and we don't often admit that, you know, company commanders, battalion commanders have bad days. I had about 3 or 4 days. And I think had it not been for our DCG kind of imploring us and giving us some tough love, but it really stuck with me. Like, hey, you've got to move forward. And then taking on that notion of, you know, the power of yet. Like, there's still things we have left to do. And then positive affirmation. Right after that AR, I'm driving with my command sergeant major back to the battalion. And I got a message from my boss. You know, it was a sentence. I highlighted what he said word for word in the article. But hey, you're doing a good job. I would have my kids go to war with you. Like, I needed that because I was at a very low point. And again, Charlie, none of this is groundbreaking, but I'm a battalion commander with 19 years in the Army, and I had to realize, like, people need to know when they're doing a good job. And that picked me up more than anything else. And then it kind of parlayed into that power of yet. So when we would sit there and I would talk with company commanders, like, hey, you know, we haven't defeated the enemy yet. Hey, we haven't done X, Y, or Z yet. And it really helped me serve as an anchor to work through adversity because it was a hard rotation. And we look at, yeah, I'm cognizant being on a podcast that's had, you know, Medal of Honor winners and Silver Star winners and folks that have done very real, very hard, very dangerous and deadly things that I was at JRTC for this experience. But what the CTCs can provide, you know, we had over the course of about a 10-day force on force, we took about 610-ish soldiers into the box. We took over 800 casualties in 10 days. When you look at just the level of contact that you're in, and that's something that you're going to be looking at when we look large scale combat operations, like that's probably what you're at. You know, it would be a different battalion in a couple of days. I talk about, I was at the World War II Museum in New Orleans for a staff ride we did for the leaders training program when we were down at Fort Johnson earlier this year. And they brought up, you know, the 4th Infantry Division. I think this is a great statistic when it landed on Utah Beach on June 6th had something like 14,000 soldiers assigned to it. And by the time they went to the Hurricane Forest, you know, what, 4 or 5 months later in November, they'd already taken 22,000 casualties, meaning, you know, every person that had landed over on Utah Beach was either, you know, killed, wounded, captured. And it's not always true, you know, because the replacements can kill, but just looking at those staggering numbers, and we have to be ready for that. And I think that's where, you know, it's a very grave business that we're in. And the importance of positive and present leadership, I'll talk about in counseling with my officers, positive and present leadership exercise with dignity and respect and grounded in doctrine, policy, regulation will always lead to success. And I stole that from somebody like I steal most of my things from because I'm not that original. But it's important, right? Because part of being a leader is being present. And that should go without saying, but you know, I found myself at JRTC. We had two tropical storms come through and it was like pouring rain and you're sitting to talk. And it's like, I'm going to go walk around and go talk to soldiers because like they're out there in the rain. And it seems, yeah, that's what we would do. But you see it so often that like people don't do it. And that's like leaders at echelon. You know, you have to be present. You have to be positive. I am a naturally kind of glass half empty kind of guy. So for me, it's hard to kind of get up and be positive, but I realized a long time ago that that was what my formation needed was they don't need a battalion commander who's yelling at people and screaming at people. And it doesn't mean you can't be stern, but you have to be positive. Cause I go to, you know, had my boss not send me that message about you're doing a good job. You know, I try to carry things back. So I talked about in the article, you know, my company fire support officer, she really got beat up and I think it was her second AAR and I could tell it was bothering her. And, you know, so take her aside and be like, hey, you're doing a good job. If you weren't doing a good job, you wouldn't be in my striker everywhere I go. Like, I need you to forget about what happened. I need you to move forward. I need you to keep doing what you're doing because you're doing a good job. Because so often for leaders, I think we don't take that time for positive affirmation. And so, yeah, positive and present leadership, dignity and respect should go without saying, but too often I think leaders forget dignity and respect. And then really, you know, for the cadets, we start looking at like doctrine, policy, and regulation being the things that drive us and like the rules and the laws, if you will, whether it's, you know, Army Regulation 600-20 or a local policy or, you know, doctrine. Like, this is how a platoon conducts a dismounted attack. Like you have an obligation to learn that stuff because that gives you the answer, or at least a guidepost to find the answer. But I found the rotation to be, I think I went in there a little bit with a little bit of hubris thinking, oh, I've already done a CTC rotation. I know JRTC will be different, but it can't be that different. And, you know, we went to NTC and, you know, we seized Rosicia in like 2 hours and nobody's ever done that before. Like this battalion knows what it's doing. And we got kind of humbled. And I realized when I came out of the rotation and I was sitting in North Fort as we're getting our stuff sent back, because like I have something that I want to say, because I, for the first time in a while, felt like an abject failure. And if I don't tell that story of, you know, failure happens. And I think there's the, you know, how do you, and this is a challenge for leaders, actually, you know, how do you create an environment where people can fail without being a failure? I felt like, you know, all the fails we had led up to me being a failure. And then that whole, the whole idea of move forward is where I was able to kind of make the switch and be like, okay, you're not a failure. You've been failing, but here's the things you need to do. You know, be positive, actually get some sleep, reaffirm people in order to kind of move forward from that point. And I felt like I had something to say that might resonate with a few people that might be feeling the same thing. And we just don't talk about it enough as an army, because we do things that are hard each and every day, and we might be asked to go forward and, you know, send a platoon or a company or a battalion, you know, into a meat grinder, you know, that results in the loss of that organization. And those are hard things to look at. I was a history major at West Point. I consider myself a, you know, minor historian of the 9th Infantry Regiment. And when I look at our regiment's history, you know, spanning from 1855 to the Global War on Terror, I find myself continuously going back to the Korean War, and whether it was on, you know, the Naktong River line at the end of August, early September 1950, where the regiment had 5 Medal of Honor winners in 4 days, or later on in the war, when the Chinese entered up in North Korea on the Hwachon River, where the regiment got wiped out basically in one night. Like those are the type of things that we're talking about. And we don't realize it. You know, I had the honor going to a reunion of our battalion's Vietnam vets this last year. You know, some of those guys were in March 2nd, 1968, the Hoc Mon ambush in our Charlie company, where they lost 49 soldiers in 10 minutes. And we think of Vietnam not being this large-scale combat operation. And it was predominantly, you know, coin, but you never know when that's going to happen. And to essentially have a company wiped out in 10 minutes. And, you know, and these guys are now, you know, what, 60, 50, 60 years later, and like the impact it's had on their lives. So I think, you know, it, for me, when I look at kind of full circle, being an officer that came up in the GWAT, and there's very relevant combat experience there, because there are things when you see people, when you get shot at, when you see people get killed, that you can't replicate no matter what. And it puts a real sense of ownership, and a you know, this is reality on it. And then to kind of, as we move forward into, you know, the potential for what the next fight looks like, when you look at Ukraine, you know, it's going to be, you know, casualties the likes of which we haven't seen, and we have to be ready for that. And I think, you know, our army learns that history, or learns that lesson the hard way over and over again. And that's where I think, you know, the NTC rotation, or excuse me, the JRTC rotation was great for us, because we saw that, you know, it was constant contact with the op four. And, you know, every time a company commander would come up, hey, sir, I'm down a platoon. Hey, sir, I'm down to one platoon. And it's like, okay, what are we going to do with the forces available? And okay, hey, first platoon Bravo company now works for Alpha company, because that's all that's left. And I need to, yeah, I need to consolidate and reorganize to continue the fight, and nobody's coming to save us. And I think that was where I was most proud of the battalion, was kind of after our initial hiccups, was just this, like, we're going to get the mission done no matter what. Nobody's coming to save us. We have two battalions in the north. We're going to be down in the south, and we're going to be in contact every day. And, you know, and our soldiers performed just amazingly, under really hard conditions. I mean, Geronimo, the op four, is going to make it hard there no matter what. But you're talking about tropical storms. You're talking about, you know, broken machinery. And as a strike brigade at JRTC, we had vehicle upon vehicle that's just stuck in the mud. And now it's like, how are we going to get that out? And it's like, we're not. So it was just, when you look at the crucible that we were in, it was a great learning experience. And for me, you know, the takeaway for me is you always have the ability to learn something about yourself and about your organization. And I don't think I learned anything that I didn't already know about myself, but it helped kind of reaffirm these things, you know, going back to that initial example we talked about in Baghdad with, you know, I knew that you've got to remain cool and calm in combat, but then you get there. And it's hard. You know, I knew as a battalion commander, you know, I talk about, you know, the lack of sleep. Hey, I should probably sleep like 4 or 5 hours a night, otherwise I'll make bad decisions. Yet I failed to do that until, like, it came to a crashing halt and I had to go get some sleep. And I think it's, you know, if I can share my failures as a leader and it can help anybody out in the army, I thought that was important to put that out there. So
have you done much professional writing? This is a relatively new phenomenon in the Army. I remember when I first came in, it didn't happen a whole lot. But as you just identified, that's an extremely useful way of sharing stories, sharing information, preparing for future conflict. Have you done a lot of that in the past?
I've done a little bit, Charlie. So it was ironic. Like, the week before this article got published, we finally got around, we had, myself and my old battalion S3 had wrote an article on our experiences at NTC, much more doctrinally based. You know, we're talking about the tenets of multi-domain operations and the role of tempo in a medium brigade combat team. So, you know, this infantry magazine kind of nerd stuff, but I thought it was important, you know, for people that are interested in maneuver warfare. I had, when I was in grad school, I had some time, and I had done some blog posting for Task and Purpose in the past. And then I was able to get my my master's thesis published by the War College. But in terms of what I thought made this article different for me was the level of kind of personal revelation that I put into it. It was a much more, and I was kind of conflicted on writing it, because I'm like, I'm being a bit more vulnerable than I kind of want to be, because I'm a battalion commander. And that's not like it's that important of a position. But you get to the point, you know, 19 years in, where you, some people, you know, myself included at the time, you'll think that you're more important than you are. And I was kind of afraid of, hey, I shouldn't be this vulnerable because this is not what's expected of a battalion commander. But as I started to write it, I just realized, one, it was kind of cathartic for me to get that experience out of my system. Cause again, I had learned a great deal, one, about the unit, but then two, about myself, and about dealing with adversity. And so it was a little bit different, of the writing I'd done in the past, but I've always found that I think it's important, to reflect on our experiences. You know, as an Army, we used to do a much better job. And what General George is doing with the Harding Project is amazing, and trying to actually get us reinvigorated, you know, modernize some of our journals so that they're more 21st century relevant. And you're not waiting on the PDF to come out in the actual magazine. But it's important because we learned through others' experiences. You know, I found, you know, reading some articles from Infantry Magazine back from the 1980s about, you know, tempo, and, you know, back then they call them, I think, regular infantry instead of motorized infantry. But like, there's things you can learn that are timeless, and it's important on us to kind of write those things down, because somebody can probably learn from your experience and then not make the same mistake, or realize, you know, what I hope to do with this article is make sure that leaders understand, like, everybody fails at times. And it's how you fail without being a failure, which is driven by how you react and what you do about it, that really matters. So I found it to be a good exercise in terms of, you know, professional development and trying to jot down some of my lessons. So,
well, Liam, I appreciate your time today. It was a fascinating discussion about Iraq and Afghanistan and JRTC. I know that you're now at Fort Liberty and you're enrolled in some courses down there, so I won't take too much of your time. But I did want to make sure that we gave you the opportunity to anything else, words of wisdom or thoughts that you have that you'd like to leave it with before we close up.
Yeah, Charlie, I think for your audience, I've said a lot of it before, but it's, you know, how are you going to come to your unit as a platoon leader? If you're, you know, a cadet looking to commission or really in any position, how are you going to be, you know, positive and present? How do you create an environment? Because this is where we struggle, where your subordinate leaders can, you know, fail without being failures. That's hard. Like, I don't have a good answer. I think JRTC provides a good environment for that. But we have to get there before, because I think we learn a lot more. I think, you know, some of the, yeah, I would contend, you know, of the kind of three main topics we talked about today, two of those I would consider failures on my behalf that I've learned from. And fortunately, you know, that my direct actions didn't lead to anybody losing their life, but that's the consequences we're talking about. So how do we create an environment where, you know, and we don't, it's hard to do a training event and not do the best, right? But that's something I found myself when you realize sometimes, you know, how are you developing your subordinates so that they can step up? You know, I was at JRTC, you know, there was a point in time, I think one of our companies didn't have a single platoon leader for like 3 days because like they're all dead, you know, so there were like staff sergeants that were platoon leaders. You know, how do you create that environment? You know, that was something, because we look at large scale combat operations and like understanding the succession of command is important, because the chances are, you know, it can't just be succession of command, platoon leader, platoon sergeant. You know, like people have to understand when it happens. Okay, then it's first squadron and weapon, whatever the case might be, it needs to be known, because you can't just do it on the fly. Otherwise, you're going to lose, you know, the command of that element in contact. But that goes to that point of make, you know, having the ability to fail without being a failure. But then for, you know, for your listeners, it's what do you do with that failure? And I think that's where, you know, I got very close to a point, you know, I've done a lot of personal reflection where like the first 3 or 4 days of this rotation almost broke me. Like I was like, man, this, I just can't do anything right. And then we can't do anything right. And it took that, you know, one, the tough love from our DCG on, you know, move forward to like, forget about the past. You guys can do better and you need to start doing better. And then that notion of like the power of yet and giving people positive affirmation, you know, find, you know, the mantras, if you will, that you can anchor yourself to, that when times get tough, you can repeat those things in your head. You know, I've put out a bunch of kind of pithy, you know, soliloquies on leadership, but they've helped me in the past when I look back, you know, when conditions are at their best or conditions are at their worst, leaders need to be at their best, because there are things that I fall back on that when you're sleep deprived, when you're in a tough position, you can just go to and be like, this is the leader I'm supposed to be, because, you know, whether, you know, it's in training or in combat, you know, that you're going to get tested in ways that you've never been tested before. And as a leader, whether it's a team leader, a company commander, a platoon leader, like your soldiers need you to be not the leader you want to be, but the leader they need. And that means, you know, it's somebody who's calm and collected under pressure. It's somebody who deals with adversity and moves beyond their last failure. It's somebody that can, you know, positively, I think, you know, the role of positivity I talked about in the article, you know, positivity as being a pacing item. I learned that from one of my friends after the rotation. I'm like, man, that is sound, because if you're not positive, there's other people in your organization, if you're a commander, that can probably be that hammer. that drives things down. But if you're the person that, you know, that isn't that happy leader, not saying you need to be nice to everybody, and there's a big difference between leadership and likership, but if you are always negative, like, how does that inspire people to want to be their best version of themselves and you? Because they all raised their right hand and agreed to support and defend the Constitution of the United States. And nobody forced our soldiers to be here, and they deserve that leadership. So those would be some of the things, you know, kind of in closing, kind of scattered all over the place that I would think of.
Liam, thank you so much for your time, and good luck at Fort Liberty and with the rest of your command.
Thanks very much, Charlie. Really a pleasure to be on here. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The Spear. The Spear is produced by the Modern War Institute at West Point. What you hear in each episode are the views of the participants and don't represent the position of West Point, the Army, or the U.S. government. Be sure you're subscribed to The Spear on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app, where you can also give the podcast a rating or leave a review, which helps us reach new listeners. And if you aren't yet following MWI on social media, please find us on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Thanks again for listening.